On January 16, 1987, sports writers Bob Ryan and Terry Pluto watched the game between the Boston Celtics and the Cleveland Cavaliers more closely than ever before. They'd covered lots of basketball games in their careers, but this one was special for them. That night's game was to be the focus of a book they were writing entitled 48 Minutes, A Night in the Life of the NBA. Bob Ryan is the basketball writer for the Boston Globe. I asked him how he came to write a detailed play-by-play account of a single basketball game.
The idea came from Terry Pluto, who had been taken by a baseball book written approximately 3 years ago called Nine Innings. And that book by Daniel Okrent explored a 1982 Milwaukee-Baltimore American League Baseball game. And his aim was to use the one game as a microcosm of the whole to explore the strategy and psychology of baseball. And quite frankly, we appropriated the idea for basketball.
How did you keep track of every move in the game?
Well, I, in the general course of things, in covering the Boston Celtics, keep the game on what we call the running sheet. And in that, you record each basket, the time, as quick as and as succinct a description of the shot as possible, what the score is, and the scoring margin along the way. I then watched the videotape of the game and broke it down play by play, literally, who did what each player did, where he went on the floor, and what he did. And then that took approximately 6 or 8 hours. And then I watched the game in the company of a professional. In my case, it was Jimmy Rogers, the assistant coach of the Celtics, and Terry Pluto did the same thing with Lenny Wilkins, the coach of the Cavaliers, so that when I sat down to write my section, I had three accounts of the game in front of me: my original notes, my detailed notes gleaned from the exhaustive breakdown of the tape of the game, and the notes I had made while watching the game on tape with Jimmy Rogers.
Was that fun to sit with a coach and do that? Did you get
It was fun. It was instructive. I have covered the NBA since 1969. I've written other books on basketball. I pride myself on having a better than average knowledge of the game compared to the average fan. And I cannot stress how informative it was for me to pick the brain of someone of that stature while having the graphic illustration right in front of us, the opportunity to run the plays back and to see how people react to situations and have him explain what was taking place and why and what possible motivations existed in the minds of all the principals was for me, a basketball fan, a terrific experience.
Now, the Celtics won this game in overtime against the Cleveland Cavaliers. You cover the Celtics. Did you feel any pressure to do a game that the Celtics had won?
We, quite frankly, wanted very badly to have the Celtics win the game, and had the Celtics lost the game, we would have felt that we had a less desirable commercial property.
Why?
Because the Celtics are the Celtics. People who follow pro basketball fall into a very strong emotional patterns with regard to the Celtics. Most people out there hate them or love them. There's not very little neutrality involved. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're wrong, by the way. Maybe this was a silly assumption, but I know that both of us felt a great sense of relief when the regulation ended in a tie rather than a Cleveland victory, and had one little idea popped into the head of one player, it's quite possible Cleveland would have won the game in regulation.
Well, the game you dissected here was a home game for Boston at Boston Garden. Why is it that so many professional teams, you know, even the best teams, mm-hmm. win at home and they tend to lose on the road? Why is that?
If we knew the complete answer to that, you and I could get very rich very quickly. There are many reasons advanced in general why teams play better at home than on the road. Among them are superior motivation to perform well in front of home fans and home management. Two, they're simply more comfortable there. They know the rims, the lighting, the floor. There's just a general overall feeling of comfort and security that is present at a home game. Thirdly, and something that I think is quite important, is the drastic change in the outlook of officials with regard to the average home team versus the average road team.
Meaning
the average home team can feel free to be more aggressive on offense and on the rebounding than the average road team. Fourth reasons, and now it gets into the idea of travel, perhaps the vagaries of the schedule, the circumstances under which a visiting team arrives in the city and is forced to play. This is quite understandable. This has always been a factor.
I was thinking that on any subway in America, you can probably count on seeing two kids talking about the players and the plays as if they're talking about people they know intimately, as if they just seen them yesterday or they live with them. You know that scene.
Yeah, sure. There's certain very immediate things about basketball as compared to other sports. The television of basketball puts people's faces right in your living room, very, very close up, and you're there in a very sparse outfit. And I think it just it lends itself more than all of the other three primary team sports to familiarity, and for people really feeling that they know something about that player personally, and watching that player perform, each player has sort of a personality to his game that's highly identifiable.
Well, thinking about those two folks sitting in the subway, talking about every single detail of the player and the team, I wonder, and you talk to the athletes, how do the athletes respond to this sports fan obsessiveness?
That's a very interesting question. My observation, personal opinion, based on 18 years of communication with these athletes, is that approximately 90 to 95% of them do not know how to respond to that, that have no conception what it would be like to be on that subway, to be anticipating games in which they are not a direct participant. They are just so athletic and immediate, and they can accomplish what they want to do by doing it rather than by watching it, that it's difficult for them. Only the very rare one who has a strong interest in another sport of which he is a fan can relate to this.
Are you saying the athletes think that obsessiveness is a little weird?
Even though they put all the time and effort that they put into playing, they can't quite relate to the motivation of fans to do it. No, they think it's, some of them are weird, and of course they really think they're weird when it manifests itself in some of the scenes that they go have to put up with regard to the really oppressive autograph seekers, the people who camp out in the lobbies of America's hotels and in the lobbies of arenas with giant books after giant books, and there are familiar faces that you see year after year. There's a fellow in Boston who was alluded to in our book who must have, because I've been watching him do this for 15 years or so, must have hundreds of large autograph books that are completely replete with duplication, and I can't imagine what he does with them, or you know, what is the end of all this? We're talking about a 55-ish man. Yeah. It's a little scary. They're the kind of people that, you know, when after the family's been wiped out and the police have been summoned, and the next door neighbor says, "But he was such a nice, quiet man. I don't know what drove him to this." You know, they'll have that look, and there's a lot of those weirdos out there, and so not only the players that who can't relate to them. I mean, it's difficult even for we in the press who have a far stronger sense of what's going on in the daily world, can't relate to those people.
If you magically climbed inside the minds of most sports fans, would you find that most of them all fantasize that they're making that shot as Larry Bird, you know, aims for the basket and lets go?
Sure. I say most, yes, is an appropriate, not all, but a majority. There's that vicarious thrill factor exists for an awful lot of us. But I mean, I don't know, personally, I guess because I deal with it in a different way, covering it and writing these games and watching them and the way I have to watch them, that thought doesn't cross my mind very often. But I must say, when I am done with that and pick up a ball and go out to shoot myself, shoot the baskets myself, at times I can understand that.
When you're out there shooting baskets, who are you, Larry Bird?
No, that's so far beyond, that what he does, it takes all the fun out. I mean, you can't even imagine what it's like to stand out there at the three-point line and throw them in the way he does, because it's unattainable. It truly is. It's like, I don't think that there's one person in a million could legitimately aspire to develop the kind of game Bird has developed. It is that rare, and he is that special.
Basketball writer Bob Ryan is the co-author of 48 Minutes, A Night in the Life of the NBA, published by Macmillan. You're listening to Fresh Air.